Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
The most famous rebel there is in our Bible, the rebel Korah himself. Numbers chapter 16 through 18. So before I go into these details, this particular chapter, of course, and the nature of it, if there are any questions or comments, you're welcome to go ahead and display them or lift them up, lift your hands up if you have a comment or something that didn't quite make sense to you or how I read it. In this instance, we have obviously a continuation of a rebellion that apparently began back with the spies. Now, be aware that our Bibles are not written in chronological order. We know that. It actually says it's not. But it's written in topical order. So we have to assume or believe or interpret that the spy section being stuck with the rebellion of Korah, the topic itself is the matter of study, not necessarily the sequence of events. So for example, the spies, we know when it occurred. It occurs during their second year toward the grape harvest time period, which is probably like September, October time period, when the 10 spies rebelled. Sometime after that, it could be weeks, years, we don't know, Korah's rebellion takes place. We don't know the timing, but it apparently is somehow following suit or follows the spy event. I'm not sure how much time lapsed between the spy event and Korah. The reason we know it follows is because the people complain about the fact they're going to die in this wilderness. Well, they didn't know they're going to die in the wilderness until after the spy event told them they're going to die in the wilderness. So they have this understanding, okay, now we know we're going to die, so we know this Korah event is sometime after. My personal opinion is probably a short time after. That's my opinion. I could be wrong, but that's where my viewpoint is. Short time meaning probably within weeks or months of the spy event. That's my personal opinion. Now, I say that mostly due to the fact of the individuals involved. Dathan and Abiram were relatively young men, relatively meaning about the same age as Moses, probably in their 70s or thereabouts. Korah's also are the same age as Moses, probably in their 70s. And these aren't going to be men who have been around since they were in their 90s or down in their 20s. They're about the same age. We said because we know who they came from and their genealogies. So the general idea of approximately ages, they're all of similar range of Moses' age. So they're probably also all in their 80s, 70s, 80s, something like a ballpark. Korah appears to be a little bit older, but we're not quite positive on that, as opposed to Dathan and Abiram. But they're all about the same age. So they all came out of Egypt. They all went the same experiences. They all have no desire, I assume, to die in the wilderness. So they have great desire to take over and say, hey, no, I'll be in charge. Give it to me. I'll fix all this because I'm better and smarter than you are, Moses. Anyway, so that's my opinion as far as the timing. Are there any comments or questions regarding this Torah portion? The things we read so far, because I may not get to all of them. My intent today is to focus a bit of attention, of course, obviously on Korah and his technique of rebellion, the method he chose to use, as well as, let's see here, the other topics. Oh, as well as how that technique is highly effective, but also is reused, in a manner of speaking, in the book of Luke and John. Yes, Deborah, you unmute yourself so we can hear you, dear. Oh, you're still muted. No, there you are.
Okay. So I'm asking about, you know, when it's talking about the meat offering.
Yes.
That you're supposed to give the best, the right thigh, you say?
Right. The right thigh portion or the hip right portion of the clean animals are offered or given to the priests. Yes.
So I was just talking to Rose. I was wondering if that's like the filet mignon or the ribeye or, you know, the reason I'm curious is because then if that's like the choice meat, but I don't know where that piece is on a, on a, on a cow.
Yeah,
and I was just wondering, if we never ate that, we wouldn't, unless I've eaten it now, I wouldn't realize how delicious it is. You could cut it with a fork.
So I can't speak, honestly, although I took my agriculture classes many, many years ago, and it told me all the details of how the animals are formed apart. I don't remember them. It's been a couple decades now. But in the details when it comes to animals, it is the right thigh. So it is the back hind quarter, hind section. So it's usually like either the right hip, his right hip, the back leg. So we think of like a what's that roast called?
Can't be a rump roast.
Thank you. Rump roast.
Oh,
which is interesting roast? Because currently it's a rump roast. Currently in Jewish tradition, the back half of the animal is classified as unkosher, meaning not edible. That's actually, to be fair, that tradition comes from a compilation of a whole bunch of stuff.
Right.
And amongst that group is that the tail, the idea of the tail is sacred for God. He's supposed to eat the tail of an animal, so theoretically they put that aside for him. And the right thigh, the right back rump roast is also for the high priests or priesthood, so they're not supposed to eat that. So modern day Judaism has taken, modern day meaning the last couple thousand, about a thousand or so years, have taken those components. Says, well, we'll just divide the animal in half. The back half is not edible. They will only eat the front half now, being the kosher part of the animal. The kosher rules is not because the back half is unclean. It is not designated for everybody else to eat it. And that's how they interpreted the rules. I can't see the right and wrong, but that's what it is. That's what modern day rules are. But that would have been the rump roast, or would have been part of or a chunk that belonged to the priesthood itself, as opposed
So oxtail soup then, right?
Right, oxtail soup.
Well,
and this is interesting, in the rules about the tail specifically spell out, I believe it is the sheep, it actually specifically states the sheep, if I recall correctly, in the Torah. But I assume or believe it may also include the ox or the goat. I'm not positive about that, but the sheep tail is specifically for God. I can't say necessarily the ox or the goat, but we just got a steer this past week and had two, or yesterday, had an oxtail package, right? Or two. Okay, one leftover from last year. So we didn't eat it last year.
So also what I was going to say is that, and today, how does that apply to today? Like giving our God best as an offering?
Okay.
That we give our offering to him?
Right. So this is an interesting scenario. In when it comes to ordinary person, this we're not referring to Levites, ordinary schmoes.
Right.
We're here like us. All right. We're just ordinary guys.
We give to guys. Them.
The rules about the best of the 10 is not applicable because God just says the 10th. Now, for example, so if you have 9 of something, you get a 10th one. That 10th one, whether it's good or bad, makes a difference. Belongs to God. So if I have, for example, I don't raise animals, but if I did, let's assume I had 9 sheep and then nine new sheep, not the existing ones, but new ones. So they all gave birth and nine new lambs are popped out, but then a 10th one comes out from another mother. The 10th one might be lame.
Right.
Doesn't matter.
It goes to God.
It goes to God. Now, the Levites, they themselves accumulate all of it and they say, okay, I've got all these, let's pretend now we're talking about a Levite person now, who's not me, not you, but a Levite that's not a high priest either. He's okay. I had all these people gave me sheep. This one gave me one. This one over here gave me 3 because he had 30 this year. All this stuff. I have all this stuff. Oh, where he's got. So he's okay. Of these, I see that there's 2 that are lame. Others look pretty decent, not great shape, but they're a little small, a little scrawny, but they're okay. And there's one over there that actually looks the better one. That's the one he has to choose. So the Levite's responsibility, it's their job to say, okay, I'm going to take all the accumulated groups, pick the one that is the best, and that's his job to pick the best one that goes to the high priest, in this case, of course, to the Messiah. That's how the structure was supposed to work. Now, I can't say it always worked that way, but that's what was supposed to work. And it specifically states in the Torah that if, for some reason, an ordinary person like me sees a 10th one and it's lame or missing a leg, for example, born birth defect, whatever, is missing something, it's got some problem, I cannot exchange it. If I attempt to exchange it, both it plus the one I exchanged with, both go to God. So I've lost them both, so to speak. Or you could say lost, or just I gave both. You argue with the word lost necessarily as a loser. But anyway, the point is that that's how the nature is supposed to work. So we ourselves, instead of choose the best, we just choose a tenth one, and then that is divided up and the best is chosen later. And the best, of course, is given to the high priest. In our case, would be Messiah himself, because that's supposed to be our high priest. The best given to him amongst all the groups that we have grouped together from our gifts and offerings.
So maybe, for me and my family, I'm the tenth lamb that's not the best, but Yeshua is going to keep me anyway, right?
Well, from Messiah's instructions he's given to us and his teachings, he has taught us that the most valuable thing he seems to focus his attention on, if you read, go through all of his different lists of instructions and parables and lessons, he spends a lot of time on the concept of what is righteous, to be a righteous person, to be righteous. And from what we know about the time period of which he was alive, the definition of righteousness was grouped along with the concept of generosity, of alms, of kindness toward the poor. That was a larger percentage of the idea of righteousness. So if I was going to say, okay, what did Messiah actually want the best, what he wanted the best of was, well, how generous are you? How kind and giving are you? That would be the most valuable thing. He spent so much time talking about that topic versus other topics. Now, is that not say he discounted anything else? I'll say he discounted, you know, righteous living as far as meaning the idea of, you know, don't do evil things. No, he wasn't saying that you can't do evil stuff as long as you're generous. No. Doing good stuff is important. Amongst the good things you do, your generosity is the cream of the crop. The best there is the generosity of what you give. That's how he valued. So he seemed to value things in that order of all things are important in the Torah and how to live. But of the best of those things is the alms, charity, righteousness section. That would be the superior or the most valuable portion of it. So if we were going to apply a tithe type of giving concept to that, as an, okay, I have all the stuff God is instructing me to do. I obey these the best I can in whatever capacity I'm able to. But then if I want to choose what is truly the best of it, I take my righteous, my kindness, my giving component and give that as the true offering here, Messiah. I'm doing this in your name. I'm giving this in your name, in your value, in your instruction. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. If it doesn't make sense, flag me and I'll try to explain it differently in different words. But that seems to be most of his focus. And to be fair, it's not just his focus alone. To all the various rabbis during his time period, that concept, the most valuable part of all righteousness was the free will giving, the offering with we call a good eye or a light in your eye, as opposed to darkness in your eye, a light meaning generously, a darkness meaning unwillingly. The light being that valuable. And that's been typically taught for 2,200 years since the first teaching of that came about. A couple hundred years from Messiah was, 150 years from 150, 160, something that right ballpark. Before Messiah was born, that teaching popped up as well. It appears to be the generosity, the kindness of giving being the most valuable component that God desires of us. Not to say the righteousness of other conduct isn't also important. That is too, but the most valuable thing is the generous giving. So I guess that would be the
category. Larry has his hand up.
Who does? Sorry, I didn't display.
Yeah. So
who was it?
Larry.
Oh, Larry. Go ahead, Larry.
I was wondering what it means when it says in chapter 18 that the Levites would bear their iniquity and that they would bear the iniquity of the tabernacle.
What's right. That's a great topic. I think that's in my notes. I'm going to double check if I talk about that or not. Let's see here. Levites. Yes, their assignments, their jobs are being modified. Okay, so.
Okay, I'll wait until you get to it then.
Well, yeah. I don't know what time. I might get to it. Basically, God is modifying the Levite assignment. We know from previously, Levites were given a certain task, like the tribe of Gershom is given a certain task of burning the tent posts and the outer coverings and such, and dragging those along. And then Merari has their components. I think of I forgot. One has the fabric and one's got the post, and I forget which one has which. And then the Kohath family of Levi is supposed to give like the holy things, carry the ark and carry the altar, things like that. Well, what God's doing is that basically he's giving an additional assignment that was not originally spelled out. It was originally spelled out in some ways, but not as clearly in this instance. So he's modifying the assignment for Levi and saying, hey, not only are you responsible for carrying all this stuff around and setting it up and doing all the kind of good stuff that you're supposed to do, your job is also to protect or separate or distinguish or divide up the children of Israel from the sanctuary. They must be kept separate. You stand in the middle. If you don't do your job, you're guilty. Not the children of Israel guilty. You're guilty for not doing your job. So it's their job to keep the separation built up. If they don't do the job, it's like a police officer. Exactly, like the police concept. Right, police. I mean, not quite that bad. But the idea of being that their job is essentially to police the people. Say, hey, you bring your offerings to us. We are the insulator between the tabernacle and you. You bring it to us, then we will. It's our job to safeguard this agreement. Then I will take your offering, whatever it is, and bring it to the priesthood and let them offer it accordingly to whatever your name is or whatever the rules are according to the offering. And so it's their job to do so. If they fail to do so, it is not the responsibility, meaning it's not the sin upon the children of Israel per se, although they may be corrected for it or punished for it, is not dominantly their responsibility. It is dominantly the Levite responsibility for doing it correctly, because the closer you are to God, the more he's going to expect of you. That's just how he says so. He told Moses that. You get closer to me, I'm going to require more of you. So Levites being close to the general assembly of children of Israel, more is required of them. He expects them to understand what you can and cannot do, who is not permitted inside the tabernacle of meeting. Then on top of that, the high priests, the priests themselves, they're responsible to protect the ordinary Levites. Say, okay, guys, you can come this far, we can't go any further. We have to take it from this point on. So and if they fail at that, the high priesthood is then responsible for anything that goes wrong with the Levites because they didn't guard them properly. So it's a process of taking care of and doing the closer you are to God, the more God is expecting of you. He told Moses and Aaron that when Nadab and Abihu died, he told them, hey, you come close to me, I expect more of you. I will be honored the closer you are. The further away you are, yeah, okay, I'm more forgiving. But the closer you are to me, I expect more of you. So he put the Levites close to him. He has a rule for them to follow to guard the ordinary children of Israel away. Don't get too close, at least they get injured or die. And then the high priest and his family is supposed to even do beyond that for the Levites themselves, so they don't get any closer. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. So basically, he's just modifying or adding, I should say, an additional task that was not originally spelled out to the tribe of Levi in chapter 18, verse 2. Actually, a few verses there. Most of the first section of 18. He spells all that out. Any other questions or comments regarding this Torah portion so far? All right, let me go into my spiel then. So first of all, go back to my starting page. I'm going to switch cameras to go to the other camera. Is it this one? It is. Oh, change background. So this course, Torah portion regarding is Korah itself. We were discussing Korah. We get to understand a little bit about who he is and where he came from. We understand it, obviously, that there are certain, obviously, that spells out that he's obviously the son of Levi or son of Kohath. But Korah himself actually has a genealogy and such. I'm not going into genealogies today. I'm just giving you a background of who the guy actually was. So in this case, Korah himself, I need to give myself enough room here. I'll rewrite over here. So Korah, his dad was Kohath, whose father was Levi. Now, we obviously know Levi. Levi obviously came, one of the sons of Jacob. So Levi and Kohath Kohath was born in the Canaan before Jacob came down to, before Jacob came down to Egypt. But Sokoth was a young man, probably a child or teenager, not sure his exact age. And of course, he later has Korah. Now, Levi, of course, has other sons too, mind you. Korah's not the only guy. There's Merari and Gershon. These are the sons. Mind you, I wrote this backwards because technically Gershon's the oldest. Korah's the middle kid, middle child syndrome, possibly, I'm not sure. And Merari's the youngest one. But anyway, I wrote it backwards. So these are the sons. Korah obviously is one of the various sons. I misspoke. Korah's not a son. Izhar is the father of Korah. I apologize. What did that down wrong? So Kohath has a son, Izhar. Izhar has a father of Korah. Izhar has brothers. Izhar's got Amram. Now Amram is the oldest of Korah's Kohath's children. That mind you, and he also has Hebron and Uziel. These are the guys I'm not going to focus the attention on. Amram, however, matters because who's Amram? He's the dad of Moses and Aaron. So Issachar, of course, has other children too. I'm not going to go through their names because it doesn't matter. But all these guys, Korah, Moses, and Amram, are all the same generation. So basically, Levi goes into the Egypt with Kohath as a young man. Merari's probably born, I'm not sure, before or after they go to Egypt. Kohath has four sons. Of those four sons, Amram being the oldest is Moses and Aaron's dad. And Izhar, the middle kid, is Korah's dad. He has other children too. But all these guys are probably about the same age, roughly in their 80s, 70s, 80s in the ballpark. And by right, firstborn right, the sons of Gershon should actually be the ones in charge, and they're not, because God does not necessarily follow firstborn birthrights. He follows what's inside the person, not outside. So God selected, instead of the firstborn, he chose the secondborn, Kohathites, and then of them, Amram is the firstborn of that group, so he did choose the firstborn here. However, when it comes to Moses and Aaron, Aaron being eldest, Moses was the leader for most of his life. Obviously, he eventually passes away, but Aaron dies first. So it's kind of a strange sequence of how these things event, but either way, that's who Korah is. Now, on the other hand, Dathan and Abiram have their own family. I'm not going to write all of them down. I'll write it over here. So Dathan and Abiram are from Reuben. We already know who Reuben is, all right? Reuben's not the firstborn of Jacob. He had a son named Palul. I mean, he had a lot of sons, by the way. I'm just referring to this particular one that is relevant to our group and our discussion today. And Palul has a son named Eliav. And Eliav, of course, has lots of sons, actually three. Dathan is one of them. Abiram is one. And then his other youngest son is Nemuel. Sloppy handwriting. Anyhow, so that's who these guys are. So these guys, Dathan and Abiram, are the ones who are challenging Moses. They are not challenging Aaron, mind you. In the text here, it explains quite clearly. Korah is the one who's challenging Aaron. So Korah wants Aaron's job. Dathan and Abiram want Moses' job. So this is basically our basic geology of how these guys are all living in their lives and who's doing what. And Moses actually spells out to Korah in the text, says, hey, what do you have against Aaron? What's wrong with him? You want the high priesthood too? What's wrong with you, Korah? So Korah specifically is going after Aaron's position, while Dathan and Abiram, being, of course, sons of the first of the primary tribe, believe they should be, instead of Moses, they should be the leaders of all of Israel. So yeah, this basic rebellion is a twofold system. They're trying to take out both Aaron and his high priesthood, as well as separately Moses and his leadership. This is how this process is supposed to work. So a general idea of who they came from, where they are, and the genealogy, it just helps understand who these guys actually are and their descendancy. And some potentially of their motive. Mind you, because Reuben being the firstborn should have been theoretically the premier tribe, except of course what Reuben did to his stepmother, which he lost that. But then the firstborn tribe of course goes from Reuben after that event to Joseph, which isn't even on this list. Clearly Joseph has better understanding to not involve themselves in the rebellion at this point in history versus Reuben and Kohath. They have their Reuben, their own idea of right and wrong. So Julia, hopefully it makes sense as far as where they are. So go back to our other video. Is that right? All right. That's who they are. Okay, any questions about that so far? Hopefully not.
That's yeah, pretty quick. I do, actually.
Oh, go right ahead.
It's Anne.
Go ahead, Anne.
I hope I can figure what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, because in the beginning of the scriptures here, it says we're in number 16. And Korah says, I thought he said it, he rose up before Moses, and the complaint I thought was against Moses. You take too much upon yourself, for all the congregation is holy. Every one of them, the Lord is among them, and why do you exalt yourselves? Well, is it both Moses then and Aaron that he's mad at, or upset?
That's a fair question. So in Korah's original assault against Moses and Aaron, he obviously approaches them, but most specifically in this section, the first verse there, it says that this Korah, along with Dathan and Abiram, and the 200, and so also this guy named On, son of Peleth. I have no idea who he is. I don't have any record as far as who his dad is or anything like that. I assume he's from Reuben's line as well, but I'm not sure what son that is. Anyhow, the offspring of Reuben, they stood before Moses with 250 men from men of renown. So you have all these group of people show up in front of Moses first, but look what Moses instructs them to do. The 250 are supposed to bring fire pans before the tent of meeting. And of course, it tells Korah to go with them to do so, to just along those lines that this is offering. So the fire pan thing has nothing to do with Moses' position. The fire pan rule only applies to the priests. They're the only ones who are allowed to do it. So these 250 men, and Korah is amongst the primary leader of them, the 250 men that goes along with this, it appears that because they're the ones who show up with Korah, mind you, the Korah shows up with the 250 men. Dathan and Abiram do not. They stay home or stay back in the tents. So Korah with the 250 men all show up to Moses. So Korah apparently is their primary spokesperson. It says Korah said. So he's the primary spokesman. And he's all of us are holy. You know, we're all good people, blah, blah, blah. And Moses, okay, here's the solution. You offer your fire pit offerings. Now, if they were just challenging Moses' job, the fire pit offerings is meaningless because you wouldn't take Moses' job with the fire pit offering because he's not a high priest. He doesn't even belong in the priesthood. So Moses, the fire pit offering only addresses the priesthood itself. It does not address Moses in any way, because even if the fire pit offerings were all accepted and they were all now the high priests, maybe there's 250 high priests now, that would still leave Moses in charge. So that makes sense? That all it does is it swaps out Aaron and swaps him out with somebody else. In this instance, because Korah comes with these 250 men of the fire pit offerings, this instance, Korah appears to be the individual wanting or desiring Aaron's job, Aaron's position. Along with 250 men, which I'm not sure what all they involve with, like what position they necessarily wanted. Now, in this instance, when Moses then tries to address the Dathan and Abiram, he addresses them completely differently. He says, all right, now you two come, we're going to have a conversation. So he already took care of Korah. He took care of the 250 men with regards to fire pit offering. Their problem, their issue is now solved. Meaning, here's your solution, here's your test. Next problem. Dathan and Abiram over here, tribe of Reuben. I need to talk to you. They won't come. Of course, then God says, all right, you got to deal with this thing. And then he has to address them in person at their tents. So he has to go to them to address them. And now he points out to them that He says, you will know that I didn't do this of my own heart. So he's talking to the thought of Balaam that I didn't do this. This is not my plan of me. Now, he didn't say those type of things to the 250 men that he talked to Korah. That was addressed to Korah. And he even points out when he's talking to the 250 men with Korah, he says, what do you have against Aaron? What has he done to you? So he's assigning, or he's telling us the 250 plus Korah appears to be focused their attention upon Aaron, because that's how he addresses them. Separately from Aaron, he just thought of Balaam for himself. All right, thought of Balaam, you have issues with me. I didn't do this of my own accord. It's not my own heart. It's not my own intent to do this. I did this because God selected me to do so. So he addresses thought of Balaam as if he's directed to himself. He doesn't do some kind of a test, like a, here, get your fire pan out. No, it's a, here's a great miracle that's going to occur. And if the miracle occurs, then of course, obviously, God sent it, as opposed to me doing it, because God obviously is the one who creates and does miracles. And the interesting thing about this test process, to me at least, one of the interesting things, is that God obviously addresses the 250 men with his fire burning out and burning them all up. And then Korah, with his, well, I can't say all his children, because apparently none of his sons agreed with Korah. They kind of said, Dad, you're off your rocker, so to speak. They told Dad, you're on your own. So Dad died on his own. But the thought of Balaam, they all perish. It's a little bit, unclear as to where exactly Korah was in all of this. Assume he is with his tent and not with 250 men. That's a slight assumption. I mean, the text kind of implies that, but it is possible, because it says the Dathan and Abiram come out, stand erect to their tents. It doesn't say Korah necessarily come out, stood erect to his tent, but it probably is there. Or it could be just his younger children who are still around, or his wives, or I don't know how many wives he has, or slaves, or who knows. Or any of the friends he may have lives in his tent. I'm not quite clear on that part, but either way, Korah and 250 apparently approach Moses with a solution of Aaron. Then Moses addresses the thought of Balaam with the solution of himself with regards to who calls forth a miracle. Does the thought of Balaam call? Say, okay, no, God, you're going to do this instead and have some bad thing happen to Moses? No, the thought of Balaam are unable to call up a miracle by God, but Moses, on the other hand, clearly is. Hence tells us that there is a distinction between these two particular individuals. That's how Moses appears to break it apart. Since he broke it apart that way, I'm breaking it apart the same way. That if he divided up between Korah, the 250 with Aaron, he divided Thon and Biram with himself, since he associated that way with his conversations, I'm assuming that is also the case. That the Korah, the 250 are against Aaron, and Thon and Biram are against Moses. And now if Moses misinterpreted or didn't word it the right way or whatever, I can't speak to that, but that's just how it's worded. Hopefully it makes sense. Any questions or comments regarding who these men are so far and their approach to this problem? All right. Let's jump through this real quick. It shouldn't take too long. Let's see here. It's a Korah's technique. Now, in this, we get the text is obviously there's a technique that Korah is using. It is a common technique used for gathering people on your side. It's actually quite commonly used today. It's still used today in politics as well as in dictatorship takeovers, meaning he calls them legal takeovers, not referring to like military takeovers. They have guns shooting. We're talking people who convince to vote themselves to select a dictator as their ruler, similar to how Hitler was done. Anyhow, so Korah's technique, he appeals to the broader population in the form of, hey, you guys are all good, holy, and great too. So you should all, yeah, pat yourself on the back. You deserve all these great things, though you didn't necessarily earn them, nor did you were granted them. They weren't given to you, but that's okay. You're still holy. Therefore, you deserve all the same stuff too. It's a matter of lifting up people, make themselves feel like, oh yeah, I'm poor or I'm not important or I'm not in charge, but I should be because I'm just as good as everybody else is. Therefore, lift me up too. It's appealing to people's base desire to be important. It's very effective. Politicians use it all the time. Like literally all the time. This is what they ever do is make other people try to make them feel important so they get the votes. The idea is that Korah, that's the technique he chose. Now on top of his technique, not just making the people feel important, because he says quite explicitly, all the people are holy, not just you and Aaron. Like we're all God's works, all of us. We're all great, wonderful people. You should lift us all up. He focuses not just upon that. He also uses the second technique that dictators use, which is you handpick individuals, strategically placed individuals, who are in charge. I used this example with my children last night. I said, hey, let's pretend there's some guy out there that convinced me, their dad, to like him. I'll vote for him because he's whatever his agreement to this or something that I think, or he convinced me of his argument and therefore I support him. He's great. What does it wind up doing to my children? Well, because I'm their father and I use the same arguments or I convince them to tell them, oh yeah, this is really important and they trust me. They likely will support the individual as well. Maybe not guaranteed, but they're more likely, more inclined to do so. Now, let's imagine for a minute, I wasn't just their dad. Let's say I was in charge of, 15 different households, like these guys are. And they trust me. Okay, these 15 different households, I'm doing this. It's better for all of us. Life's great. We'll all have, chicken in every pot kind of thing. And we'll all eat bonbons and watch soap operas all day because we'll be happy and life will be easy. If I convince all of them that way, then there's a good chance I'll get a majority of them to agree with me. So all Cora has to do is appeal to my base desire to feel important, then hand select individuals who are in strategically located positions in hierarchy or in society to represent other individuals. So for example, I'm just using this as an example, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. If the president somehow convinces our governor of California to really like him, I don't know how he did that, but that's what he does, and he says, oh, this is like the best guy since God, comes down, there's a good probability that some individuals of our own state, since our state happens to agree with our governor, or like at least most of them do, would also say, oh, well, okay, our president must be pretty good because our governor likes him. So our president, I'm not saying the current one, just this hypotheticals, could, if he could convince our primary leader, which is our governor, to say, oh, this is the best guy since God, that there's a good probability that a certain percentage of our population would then also agree, even though our president does not have to actually convince that population. He doesn't actually have to tell them or convince him one-on-one or individually or have necessarily to say, hey, this is really important, because if somebody else liked our governor, therefore a percentage will also like this individual too. I'm not saying they're a wise percentage, I'm just saying they're a percentage. Anyway, so that's how dictators work. They work pretty well that way. They don't have to convince the entire population. If it's just a percentage of them, as they've noted that between 5 to 10% of population, if you have support of 5 to 10% and their strategic supports, you can win the entire population. It's fascinating, but you can win the entire population that way. So that's how laws are typically passed in our country, the mob rule, so to speak. And that if you have 5 to 10% of the people agreeing with a rule, guess what? Rules change. You may have 95 to 90% who disagree. Makes the difference. You have the right 5 to 10%, guess what? The law then changes. So it doesn't take a whole lot to make huge changes. So hence Korah's case, he had 250 guys out of however many thousands there may be of Israel, 250 of them, it creates a rebellion and he can succeed in actually doing the job he's trying to do. Now, I'm not saying that he would succeed because obviously God's involved here, but if God was not involved, which is ordinary men, that's all it would take. It didn't take a whole lot. So Korah, of course, uses the same technique. It's very effective. Strategically placing a few people, a few selected, as it points out, these are men. These 250 men were the ones who get called up during meetings or private meetings with the leadership. So these are not just ordinary schmoes. These are guys who are actually important. They represent individuals, which means captains of the 50s and captains of the hundreds and the captains of the thousands. Those groups we're talking about, that he got 250 of them to agree. So all the people who are underneath them are also going to follow suit. Very effective. Even though they do not necessarily deserve the position, they didn't work for it, they didn't strive for it, it was not given to them for any reason, they felt that it was theirs for the taking. It is an unfair, unrighteous act, hence God does not appreciate it, and they all perish as a result. But I want to point out, though all 250 men die, there is no indication their households die. There is nothing that said their wives, their sons, their daughters, any of them suffered from this loss. So God was or appears to be focused attention upon the 250, but did not necessarily strike their families. Unlike Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, who he also struck their families. We'll have to discuss that as to why he would have done that. Let's see here. So in the case of this, verse 4, the reaction of Moses, now I would love someday for a leader to actually do this, but of course they don't. Let's pretend they did. The reaction that Moses gives in this first assault Does he fire back, say, you evil heathen, die? No, that's what our current politicians might say, but Moses doesn't react that way. What's his first reaction? He drops down on his face. That is a very humble, lowly position. Now, I don't know, I'm going to make my Daniel Ages assumption, that when he fell on his face, he was not falling on his face toward Korah, but rather fell on his face toward the temple of or God. That's my opinion. I have that opinion because falling on his face toward Korah and not toward God would place Korah in a higher position, much like how, if you recall the story of Esther, did Mordecai ever bow down to Haman? No, because if he did, it would place Haman greater than or equal to the king. And Mordecai knew that is not the case. So in my opinion, Moses, he fell down on his face. I do not believe he fell down on his face toward Korah to lift Korah up as if he is greater than Moses. I personally believe, in Ages' opinion, they fell on his face toward the tent of meeting. And I say that, of course, because God's not so thrilled. He actually talks to Moses then. So that's my opinion. Based on just the knowledge I have of what Mordecai did with Haman and how we do not treat individuals who are not assigned or given a task or given the position of importance, not treat them higher than they are. Let's see the next part, of course. Obviously, Moses gives the instructions to Korah and the 250, which is the fire pan censers. If you remember what happened to Nadab and Abihu, the two sons of Aaron, when they offered their fire pans. Remember? Zoop, yeah, like a little fire consumed them all up. So we can argue or think, which I think is what the Israelites were thinking at the time they saw this, that Moses set these guys up to die. See, Moses knew the fire pan offering thing was a killer. So he set them all up. They're all going to die. So he set them all up. So, and I think that's probably because the people seem to still, after all of this, still think, and God still has to address them over and over again, multiple times, hey guys, I really did do this. This wasn't, you know, Moses' choice. I'm actually making the decisions. And he had a hard time convincing the ordinary people that way. God's the one to die is more accurate as opposed to Moses. But there's nothing that says Moses spoke to God and God said, use fire pans. But so we have to interpret or believe that Moses had this idea and they would use fire pans. And where did Moses get the idea from? Well, think, Nadab and Abihu, that God said, only those who are, who I expect the most of those who are close to me. So if God wanted these other men to be close to him, God would have honored their offering as he does to Aaron's offering when Aaron does it. But if God didn't want them, he would dishonor the offering as he did to Nadab and Abihu. So one could argue Moses actually did have a really good idea of what was going to happen. He's not a dumb man. He's been around a while. He's seen a lot of stuff. So it's probably a good idea that we got what was going to happen. And then, of course, Moses then obviously prays to God that he says, God, don't accept their offering, which is kind of an extra little, you know, kicker to the side. Make sure this actually works out right, God. Well, our show here, so to speak. Okay. Let's see here. Jump through to... Okay, what was that, dear? Well, yes and no. My wife had asked, would that not take away Moses' humbleness? Well, in the manner of speaking, it could if you argued it that way. But in the point of that Moses has some knowledge of past. He knows the past. He knows who the Abihu were. He knows what happens to them. If God truly did want them, he would not have adhered to Moses' prayer. He would have just received them and said, it's all good. And God obviously did not, because Moses was obviously regurgitating what God told him. What I find interesting in Moses' reaction to Korah and his sons, his people, he calls Korah B'nai Levi, which means sons of, or the offspring or the descendants of Levi. But Korah is the only one recorded in this list that's from Levi. The 250 men, we're not sure what tribe they're from. Some probably are from Levi. I'm not sure how many, but some probably are. Either way, most seems to have, they said the 250 are from all the various tribes. So it appears that Korah has gotten not just, you know, the few leaders of Reuben with him. He may have some Levites with him as well as other tribes. It could be Dan could be in there. Who knows? All of them, anybody tries, 250 guys. Could be a whole bunch of them in there. But he addresses them as sons of Levi. Although our Bibles translate the word as offspring of Levi, but that's one of the more colorful ways of translating it. Sons of, or the children of, is more accurate. But anyway, so he seems a group Korah with a group of, or some of these people are groups of Levi. So the Levites, if they were Levites among them, they know the rules too. They're shockedness of this. It's like, oh no, I never would have guessed the fire pan thing. They all knew what happened to the Dabba to Bihu. It wasn't that long ago. They saw the events. They're not unfamiliar with these events. So they knew the risks they were dealing with. The thing I want to point out before I move on to the next topic is, of course, in all this spiel, does Aaron say anything? Does Aaron defend himself? Does Aaron come to his side and say, no, don't do this? Aaron keeps his mouth shut. Now, it's hard for us individuals to do. It's just, I'm just being honest, it is. Well, some of us. Okay, some of us are better than others. Okay. So it's hard to keep your mouth shut. And that when somebody attacks and said, oh, how you bad person, you evil thing, you're terrible. And just nod there with a smile, and just accept it. That's not easy. It's not a natural place for humans to be. Our natural place is defense. And no, I'm not. I'm good and you're being unfair. That's our natural instinct. So Aaron is showing great restraint here in all of this. Moses is too, to some degree as well, because he has to address them. He still has to address them. But Aaron keeps his mouth shut the whole time. He's literally saying, hey, keeping mouth shut is honestly pointing out that, okay, if God really wants these guys to be, that's fine. This is what he's doing. He's keeping his mouth shut. He's not arguing his own case. That's trying to defend himself, saying, hey, this wasn't my choice. And he's actually treating it as, okay, here's legitimate. It's possible. Maybe God didn't want me. Maybe this is, Korah is right. No. By the way, Aaron keeps his mouth shut the whole time, which is fair. And of course, Moses points out when God says, I'll kill them all off. He says, hey, one man's sin can be angry with everybody. That is a fascinating question. I have a question for you. You don't have the answer, just think about it. One man's sin, God gets angry with everybody. Think about that. Who does that remind you of? Let's see here. To me, the two people that come to mind is Adam. One man's sin, God dislikes everybody. And then the second one would be David. One man's sin, God strikes a whole bunch of people. Let's say everybody, but a whole bunch of people. Thousands die from his mistakes. So I guess to a fair question to Moses, one man's sin, God gets angry with everybody. I guess it depends on who the man is, what position he holds. One man can have a lot of sway over a whole group of people. God can correct him in particular leadership positions, such as a king like King David, or Adam, the first man of all mankind. That can affect everybody. Now, to be fair, God does not do that to everyone. Not all of us. If I make a mistake, does not necessarily kill Larry or Lee or Rose. You guys aren't punished for my mistakes. Why mistakes is not fair to punish you. But if I was in charge of a whole nation or the whole world for whatever reason, not heaven forbid, but in charge of a nation, I make a mistake, that can affect you. That can mess up your life. That can destroy you, and you can be suffering from it. Our presidents make mistakes all the time. And guess what? The citizenry suffers from it, good or bad. It happens. They make good decisions too sometimes, but fewer of those than the other way around. So one mistake, depending on who you are, God can't say, yeah, this is going to affect everybody. Not to say everybody die for it, but it will affect everybody. It does affect people versus a smaller group that affects fewer. And that's, of course, I think that's what Korah was coming from. That was his goal, get more people on his side that way. It's very effective. Let's hear. We already pointed out that Korah's sons did not support him. Numbers 26 records that. They said, Dad, you're on your own. Of course, they all die. The 250 that get burned up. I'm going to go through all these details. So I'm going to jump onto the section I want to talk about today before my time is up. Let's see here. Oh, jump to the, okay, I'm not going to go to the details of the earth opening up. You got the story. It opened up. They swallowed. They all died. They screamed, yelled, whatever. Which is funny because in Jewish tradition, it claims they recorded basically a preaching. They were down the earth preaching. We were wrong. Yeah, whatever. That's, you know, Jewish tradition. The point is they were yelling because they're all perishing and such. And then, of course, obviously, this plague passes through. Moses then uses a component from our atonement details to make atonement, the whole offering of the incense offering. He uses this component. He takes it out of, basically, he just borrows a symbol out of Day of Atonement. It's okay, Aaron, here, go. Go run. Interject, intervene, stop this plague. And of course, God obviously honors that or accepts that that offering. It stops the plague naturally. Of course, Aaron then stands between life and death, which we discussed before, that Aaron standing between life and death is a good symbol of Messiah himself, standing between life and death. We won't go into that anymore. That too much detail unless you have questions regarding it. I'm going to jump a little bit to the last testing thing that God comes up with. This is what the God does for a testing. He does the staves. One from each tribe, 12 tribes total, which means Joseph and Manasseh, or Ephraim and Manasseh, are shoved together into a single tribe. I'm not sure which staff that made it, but one of them did, because you only have 12 staffs total out of the 13 tribes. They obviously all go, they get sprouted in one sprouts, and of course, that's how it's going to work. But the people's reaction is fascinating. And the people's reaction, of course, they complain. This is chapter 17. They complain about they're all going to die. We're all going to die. Because the temple, we're all going to die. Now, there's two parts to that all going to die thing. That all die thing is that, yeah, if you go too close, you die. But also the acceptance and realization that they actually do have to suffer their 40 some odd years of wilderness. And they actually are all going to die. They have to accept that internally. It's not an easy thing to say, hey, God comes to you. Okay, great, Joe Schmuley. No offense, Mr. Carson. You're all going to die, but your sons will be okay, but you won't. Okay, as parents, okay, well, at least that's okay. It's better than nothing, right? But it's not an easy thing to accept that now that I'm going to die, I'm going to lose my dwelling. I'm going to sit there and wander around like a poor beggar for the rest of my life. That's unpleasant until I pass away. There's only not much hope there. But they have to realize that or accept that as well. They have like almost 38 more years to deal with that topic, that concept. All right. So as far as the Torah portion, that's what I want to cover. That's basically the topics we're going to discuss. If you have any questions about the Torah portion, that's fine. Let me know. I was going to jump to how the same technique that Korah used was then reused again later on. It's reused in the same technique in that strategically located individuals can rile up a very large population, even though the population by themselves would never agree to such things. It would never follow suit. In such here. What was that? Somebody had a question?
I have a question here.
Go right ahead.
And all will die if we get too close. I wrote down in my notes here that they got very emotional and they say, oh, Lord, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. But then you brought up the wandering in the desert for 40 years, that would be their fate and they would die. How did you come up with that conclusion about the wandering?
So they already had the experience with the 10 spies. So that event already occurred. And when that event occurred with 10 spies who rebelled, God then openly declared, you're all going to wander the wilderness till this generation dies. For the number of days the spies spend out, 40 days, you're going to spend 40 years in the wilderness till this generation passes away. Anybody who is 20 years and up. Those, your children who are younger than 20, they will inherit, but you will not. They already received that decree, that instruction, that condemnation from God himself. So they already got that earlier. I guess before when I started out, I'm not sure how much earlier. It could have been days, could have been weeks, but probably a relatively short time before Korah comes along the scene and tries this rebellion. Now, I say that because what was the motive of Dathan and Abiram? Dathan and Abiram says they came, the words, the choice they used was, they came from a land flowing with milk and honey, referring to Egypt. And God, Moses did not lead them to a land flowing with milk and honey, nor to give them an inheritance. So they wanted a new leadership. Now, if they want new leadership, there's only one of two things you do with new leadership. Now, since they already referred to the land of Egypt as a land flowing with milk and honey, it is implied that that land, Egypt, is being used as the equivalence to the land of Israel, because they're both being used using the same terms described to different locations. And not only the same terms, they're using the terms that God gave them, his definitions, his description. They're stealing from him and applying it to Egypt. So it implies, because they're doing that, they're saying, everybody, Egypt was just as good as this place we're supposed to be. We already tried to take it ourselves, mind you, after 10 spies did their thing. We attempted to attack it and take it anyway. And even Moses told us to stop, and we failed at it. So they already had the experience that going to the land of Israel is not going to succeed. Therefore, since land of Israel's milk and honey is the same as Egypt's milk and honey, we know we would be successfully accepted in Egypt because they wanted us back last time. So therefore, we understand that the Dathan and Abiram's objective appears to be the return to the land of Egypt, because they're equivaling that is just as good as, if not equal to, or even some places better, because they would be accepted there, as the people, as the territory of Egypt. So if we have this viewpoint, understanding of Dathan and Abiram and their objective, and that it's in this instance we have the understanding that we're all going to die, is the understanding that God had already determined they would die in the wilderness for 40 years. But if Dathan and Abiram were successful in their rebellion and taking over leadership of Moses, they could sit there and say, okay, God, you keep your 40 years in the wilderness. We're all heading back to Egypt. I'd rather live 40 years in Egypt under slavery than die here in the wilderness. At least there I got leeks and onions and everything else I got, because it's the land of milk and honey. So Dathan and Abiram, their objective is to use the same terms to describe land of Egypt as God himself used to describe the land of Israel. And they already know taking land of Israel is not possible under their own might. Therefore, they're going to redefine land of milk and honey as the land of Egypt. We're going to redefine land of Egypt as milk and honey. And they already will accept us. Therefore, we'll just go there and say, hey, we're here. Come to subjugate us. We were happy you're here. So in this case, they can bypass the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. They can just live as Egyptians. All will be good. Life's happy. We have, you know, bonbons and eating, you know, watching soap operas. So everything's good. So it appears that since they're using the terms that God used and they're applying something else as if that something else is better than or at least equal to what God described. Therefore, let's just go there. It's better. Bypass the 40 years. Now, since the rebellion failed, they do not get a new leader. They do not get a new high priest. They're not going to do anything. They're stuck with the same leaders, stuck with the same high priest, the same religion, the same rules. They accept the fact that, great, now we actually are going to die. We don't get the option. This was our best shot at rebellion, and it didn't work. So we're not going to get this option. Does it make sense? So it's a twofold realization by the people. First, yeah, don't go to the tabernacle. It'll kill us. But second, also, we actually are stuck here. We have to deal with this, accept this is our fate because of our own doing, but we have to accept it. That's not an easy thing to do as a human, to accept your own screw-ups actually have consequences and they're long-term, but this is what happens. Screw-ups do have long-term consequences. All right, let's move past this. Any other questions so far? I'm going to move on to what Messiah taught us in his life regarding the same topic. All right. So in our gospel sections, I'm going to talk about how much I got. 15 minutes. Yeah, right. All right. How quickly can I read that section? I can read pretty fast, but no one would understand a word I say. So I wasn't a John, but I think Luke, I like Luke's description a little differently because he includes a lesson that Messiah gives to us, which is very helpful in understanding Korah in his mental state of being and what his thoughts were. This lesson Messiah ended. It's recorded in Luke. He does not record it in John, but he's recorded in Luke.
Excuse me, Daniel. I think yes, Larry may have a question.
Oh, go ahead, Larry. Yeah, unmute yourself, sir. He's muted. Maybe not.
I was just going to make a comment that Cora and the group really were pretty chicken about saying he had led them into the promised land when they were the ones that rejected it.
Right. That's the second part of that, which I didn't talk too much about. When it comes to when you have an object that you can identify and put all of your angst and anger and point, see, that's the reason why my life sucks. I use that term unfairly, but that's what it is. That's how you get a population to attack a particular group. This was how it was done by Hitler, very successful, and saying, hey guys, your life's terrible because these poor pathetic Jews, these subhuman category groups are unfit. Very good at doing that, convincing a poorer population, which is his race, the Aryan race he was supporting, the German population, that your life is terrible because of these people. Therefore, get rid of them. Now, not only that, he was very successful in not just doing a target group of one group, but rather he also said, okay, there are tiers in race groups. He obviously had his group of, well, I can debate whether he was bombing the group or not. But the point is, he had a particular group on top. He had subgroups, because he obviously had the German high race, whatever. He had subgroups, which he targeted as later on. He obviously had the Ukrainians below them, the Polish below those. And of course, then you have the subhuman categories down here. And he pointed the top groups that go in order to convince them to succeed, they get to pick on not the two below them, rather the third one down. Everybody point their attention to the third one down. If you focus your attention to the third one down, the peons, so to speak, the worthless who have the money, we'll just take from them and make all these other groups and make them feel better because we'll give them more money. Their land, their property grow, they get raised up. So they're more valuable as a result, because now you have a target for your angst, your upsetness, why your life is so miserable. You can then support this crazy guy who's in charge of all this stuff and say, hey, but look, all the great stuff I'm getting as a result. Therefore, since I'm good and I deserve it and I'm just as good as they are, though I didn't work for it, I should get it. It's very effective in a method. So it is a method that transcends the actual leader himself or herself, usually himself, that he can say, okay, do these things. And this is why it's really important to do these things and pick on these people. But the reason that you want to pick on them because it benefits you in every imaginable way. Look, all this great money, the property, all the stuff you have, if you just crush these pathetic people, then if something happens to the leader, the people can maintain that philosophy and keep going with it because they like the idea of having everything they didn't work for, that they didn't just strive for, or try to actually earn or accomplish. So it's a very effective tool. So in this case, you have obviously Korah, and he directed all his attention, everybody's attention against Moses and Aaron. Something happens to him. Like, for example, God does not select him as Aaron's replacement or either the two of you men. The angst already being directed continues on beyond him. So it's a rebellion that actually is embedded inside the people by convincing them how great they deserve, how much more they deserve than what they actually have. It's very effective and still done today. It wasn't supposed to be a political speech, but it still is done today. Let's move on. Let's see here. So Luke, this is a long read. I'm going to jump to, this is Luke chapter 23. This is regarding what we're studying or looking on, the pay attention to the details of the individual people, what they're doing. Luke 23, verse 13. Right, this is recorded obviously in John 19. Is it, and a few other places too. It's also in Mark and Matthew as well. But anyway, this is one of the various accounts. So Luke 23, verse 13, it says, this is by the middle of Messiah's trial. Pilate, when he called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, he said to them, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing worthy of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him, for it was necessary for him to be released, one of them, at the feast. Stop there for a minute. So Pilate, actually having a thought in his head, I'm saying, okay, I'm going to actually analyze, is this something true? He examined the truthness of the claims, determined they were false claims. Therefore, simple answer. Here's a question. Here's a solution. Let's move on. Next problem. But of course, that is not the response. And I find this interesting, the people's response. And they all credit at once, saying, away with this man, release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain insurrection made in the city and for murder. Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus again, called out them, but they shouted, saying, crucify him, crucify him. And he said to them the third time, by why? What evil has he done? I found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices to be crucified, and the voice of these men prevailed. So we have a group of people, mind you, when Messiah is wandering around the countryside and going from town to town, healing this group, healing that group, he had a lot of people following him, didn't he? As says, the people of the town, people of the region, they would travel around, follow him, heal this, heal that, this sick person, that's it, feed us, all these things. He had groups of people following him. So the populace, the ordinary man, woman, child, populace, did not have animosity toward this individual. There's no record of saying, look, he healed me, kill him. There's nothing recorded saying, he fed me, go kill him. They weren't doing that. He fed me, that's cool, thanks. He healed me, that's great, thanks. He had support. The people supported him. But individuals, certain strategically placed individuals, meaning the high priest, those who were with them on that side, did not support him. Therefore, with just a few individuals well-placed, they can convince an entire population to do something that they would not have done on their own. It doesn't take a whole lot of people. It just takes certain individuals to do it. Certain people. Depending on what position they hold. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested. He released to them the one they requested, for the insurrection and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. Now, as it led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon of Cyrenian, that's whatever, that place, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross that might bear after Jesus. And a great multitude of the people followed him, women who mourned and lamented him. So a great multitude, the term great multitude means the people of the town, the people of the region. So the people of the region, the people themselves did not necessarily agree with what was being happening. So the populace did not agree, but certain individuals got it done because they were strategically placed. Just like the 250 men the Corps had selected, strategically placed individuals can convince an entire population to do something they would not have normally done. But Jesus turned to them and said, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed, the days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, the breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say in the mountains, fall upon us, and the hills cover us. For if they do these things in the greenwood, what will be done in the dry? Let's stop there for a minute. The greenwood and dry wood is a euphemism. It's a Hebrew idiom. Greenwood is being done something in righteousness or in holiness. Dry wood is something which is in wickedness or in deceit or in darkness. And those are two. It's commonly used. It's been used for a couple thousand years. Greenwood always meant that. Always has meant that. And dry wood always means done in darkness or in wickedness. So what he's pointing out is that they, referring to people who turned him in and to be crucified, if they did this crucifixion sentencing in what they perceive as righteousness, in their righteousness of doing this, what are they going to do when they're wicked? If this is what they define as righteousness, murder an innocent man. So what is wickedness to them then? That's his point. Wickedness must be really awful if this is what they define as righteous. Yeah. So there were also two others, criminals led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place they called Calvary, they crucified him, the criminals, one on the right hand, one on the left. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They divided his garments and cast lots. People stood looking on, even the rulers with them sneered. But the rulers with them sneered, saying, he saved others, let him save himself, if he is a Christ, the chosen of God. The soldiers who mocked him coming and offering him sour wine, saying, if you are a king of the Jews, save yourself. And an inscription also written over him in letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, this is the king of the Jews. Then, of course, one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, if you are Christ, save yourself and us. The Sanhedrin rebuked him, saying, do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we need just and we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. This man has done nothing wrong. They said, Lord, remember us when you come into your kingdom. Of course, and surely I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise. I'm going to continue on the whole story. The point of the story is that we examine this sequence of events. The ordinary people, the ordinary citizenry, would not necessarily have crucified him under these circumstances. Even these two individual criminals, presumably both of them understood, at least one certainly did, both of them understood that this guy, even though we're criminals, we're the bad guys, he didn't do anything wrong, yet he's dying with us. They would recognize he didn't do anything wrong. They didn't deserve this sentence. So obviously we can sell ourselves, we can see ourselves in our own world today. Pay attention to what's being told to you, to us, our leaders or people who are strategically located in power, what kind of power they actually wield over us and what they can convince large populations to do, even though there's few of them. It doesn't take a whole lot to make a big impact. In this case, we have a few leaders of a group of people, and regarding Messiah's time, granted there was, I'm not sure how many, I imagine a few hundred, I'm not positive. They, however, their goal was to obviously kill a man who didn't do anything wrong, though the individual citizenry did not necessarily agree, did not necessarily want him killed. They would have probably let him go, but it didn't take everybody to agree to it. It just took a small number to agree to it, a small number to convince everybody else. So hence today in our modern world, we see various things happen in our politics or individuals of doing different things, right or wrong. It doesn't take the entire population to make a huge impact, does it? We see what it's done, even these various riots and such, and they've happened. It doesn't take 90% or 50% of the population to riot to make a massive impact. It takes a small number to make a massive impact. Hence, pay attention to what's going on. Pay attention to what our leaders say, what they don't say, what they're doing, in their positions that they hold, what kind of power they hold over them. So Moses was correct when he said, God, does one man sin, you're angry with everybody? Or you can reword it and say, okay, if a few people do something wrong, do we all have to suffer? The answer is yes. A few people do something wrong, we all suffer. Now we may say, well, God, that's not just. He pointed out, hey guys, you're all going to suffer consequences. I'm not going to kill you all for it. We all suffer consequences. There are consequences to actions. There are consequences to what leaders do. There's consequences to what our culture does or doesn't do. We all suffer them as a group, whether we like it or not. It's just how it works. So Korah gave us a great lesson on how to avoid dictators and the techniques that one of the primary techniques, other than bullets flying, used to take over groups. It also gives us a great lesson in Messiah's time that a few leaders can make a huge change on a population who would never have agreed to such things to begin with. It's quite fascinating to watch. Anyhow, any comments or questions regarding this Torah portion? Things to agree, disagree, or opinions, or thoughts, or whatever else you can think of. We'll entertain it all. We've got a few minutes to give to you. Any other opinions or thoughts in this Torah portion? Korah is a good study lesson, a good subject matter to consider and think about when it comes to leaders and arguments and beliefs and peoples and opinions. And it's helpful to keep them separate. Yes.
I think this was the first attempt at communism. Because he came in saying, why are you above all these people? They're all the same. They're all as holy as you. We should all be the same. But give me the power.
Right, but give me the power. There's a detail there. Give me the power first. Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's a fair assessment of probably a various government groups, government philosophies. But yeah, first of all, communism. Yeah, but you're all equal. And it's fascinating that you're not all equally low. You're all equally high. There's communism that doesn't work out that way. It winds up being, all end up being low. So they claim they're high.
Question too. Let me unmute them.
Oh, go ahead. All right, who had a question? I didn't catch who it was.
Yeah, Larry.
Larry, you're muted. Did you have a question?
I was wondering if this is part of that thing where it says that all that is required for evil to triumph is for good men to remain silent.
That's a fairly accurate statement. Yes. It doesn't take a whole lot.
Though, if we make noise, we ought to be making noise based on the understanding of God's will rather than our own. Yeah,
right, exactly, and that's an important thing to be focused on when you're paying attention to what God asked of us. pay attention. He described using his own words in his own instruction book on what he expects, and to not put our own onto it or interpret it in our own unique or specific way. It was very helpful that he gave us examples in our Bibles of situations that people violated or went against his instructions. So you understand that he does things on his terms, not ours. So he expects us to approach him on his terms, in his instructions, not him approach us on our terms or our instructions, that we'll do things under our conditions. It is his conditions we must follow, not ours. He's very adamant about that, repeats himself over and over about that. You will do this as you have seen, as I have shown you, repeats those statements over and over to Moses and Aaron. You do this as I've shown you, as I instructed you, as you have seen. He always uses, these are his conditions. He does stuff. And so we apply these principles. It's interesting to watch or pay attention to how individuals apply them. It is important that we do our best to apply them under his terms and not our own. It's just really fundamental. If we apply it under our own terms, he's not with us. Hence, when they said the 10 spies died, they all said, oh, okay, let's go take the land anyway. Well, you're now doing it under your own terms. You're doing what he told you to do, but you're doing it under your own terms. And God said, yeah, I'm not with you. It doesn't work that way. Yes, you are doing what I told you to do earlier, but you didn't do it under my terms. Therefore, I am rejecting it. I'm throwing it away. I'm not going to allow you to take the land. So we can even do something, what God told us to do, but if we don't do it under his terms, he's not going to bless it. It's interesting to know, but God is very adamant about that. It is his terms something's done, not on our own. I may see, you know, some poor person on the streets. Oh, his purpose needs money. Here's some food. Here's some money, whatever. And having no knowledge or care about this individual, I didn't do giving on his terms. This individual could be a massive drug dealer, drug addict. I don't know. See, his terms is find them, know them, help them. These are his terms. So we do things on his terms, not our own. Our own is, why would he bless that? If I give a drug addict, you know, $100, what's he going to do? I'll go use it. Buy drugs with it. What good would that do? Did that help them? No. But if I know they were a drug addict, okay, now I can help you, but let's go have a conversation. Let's go walk through the needs that are actually beneficial to you, assuming, of course, they're willing. Then you can actually benefit. The generosity is useful in that case. It's applicable then. So again, things that are on his terms really, really matter, not on really. Any comments or questions around this Torah portion?
These miles have to hang out together.
All right. Anything else to comment? We'll close the prayer.
Hey, who does?
Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for a Shabbat day of rest, a time of study and worship and understanding what is fair and just and right in your eyes. To help us to follow you as best we can. The path you've given to us, Father, it is a good path. We may not always understand the path, but it is a good one. Because everything you do is right according to your ways. Help us to follow that path, Father. We ask you will keep us safe and keep the people we pray for safe. You keep our families, our households, our congregations, our family members, extended families, Father, you keep them all safe to know you and to be wise people. Father, it's better to be wise than it is to live long. It's very wise than to be just knowledgeable, very wise than to be prosperous. Help us all to be wise, but those things come after. But wisdom is important. Father, grant us that wisdom to teach our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, the many generations to come, what is true according to your ways. They will also be wise that they will choose the way of life and not the way of death. We ask your blessing, Father, we praise you for all these great things in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.